Blue Dot, Episode 10. How's the weather?
Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm.
And I'm Matt Schiltz. And one of everyone's favorite topics, whether you're great friends or whether you're just making small talk, is the weather.
Yes, the weather is something that's always on our minds, especially in the winter and the spring here in the North State. We have interesting weather, and we've got some interesting weather people to talk to about it today. We've got a couple of the lead forecasters from the National Weather Service office in Sacramento, the people that bring you all those alerts and things that you see on TV or hear on the radio. One of my favorite things to follow on Twitter is the National Weather Service Sacramento office. It's very informative.
And we're going to talk about those probabilities when we have a 20% chance for thunderstorms. What does that mean? How do they get there?
Yes. And we're also going to talk to Rob Elvington. He's a fantastic forecaster, I think, and a very knowledgeable meteorologist in his own right for Channel 7R in Reading.
Yeah, based up in Reading. And so he's been forecasting weather in the North State for the last 5 years about.
Yes. And he has a very strong meteorology background, which is why we're going to talk to him. We're going to find out about, you know, what these guys think about the winter we've just had and the spring to come. So first we're going to talk to our friends from the National Weather Service in Sacramento. We're going to talk to Bill Rosch and Tom Dang. Guys, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having us. Yeah, thanks for having us.
Let's look back at the winter we've had, and now that it's officially spring, did the El Niño predictions live up to your expectations?
Tom, you want me to take that one?
Go for it, Bill.
Yeah. So this is Bill. That's a great question. And you know, looking back, it definitely did not turn out exactly how we were thinking. Typically. With El Niños, we definitely get more precipitation down in Southern California. There's still some more time left in the wetting season, but certainly the way it looks right now, it probably won't be as much rain as we were anticipating. Hopefully in our message when we talk about things like this that our skill still is something that just is not that great when it comes to extended, quote unquote, extended forecasts like that. With El Niño, the signal is pretty strong as far as, you know, statistically speaking for Southern California. But even the amount of the samples we have, like six or seven strong El Niños, scientifically speaking, that just really isn't a lot of data to have a lot of confidence in. But underscores just how much we still have to learn about, especially extended forecast. There's so many things going on in the atmosphere and in the globe that we just don't understand yet. So, we try to communicate that and message it the best we can. Thankfully, though, the El Niño did bring precip, and thankfully it brought it to a place that California really needs it, in Northern California, where all the reservoirs are. So thankfully that did happen. But it didn't pan out exactly how we thought. But at least a big part of the state did get some good precipitation.
I've been following the weather. As you know, I'm very active on Twitter, and I thought this was a very interesting weather year. What were some of the interesting or unusual meteorological events you guys saw this past winter?
Go ahead, Tom.
This is Tom, and I'll lead off with that. I wouldn't go so far as to say unusual. By most standards, this past winter, the precipitation that we saw is probably going to end up pretty close to normal on the water year. But just kind of forecasting from storm to storm, one interesting phenomena that I kind of noticed was that a lot of the storms brought a lot of precipitation over our Northern California mountains, but really left a lot of the Central Valley kind of rain-shadowed in a way. So, you folks up in the North State along the Northern Valley and getting down to Sacramento, there were many occasions where we saw little to no precipitation, but it would just be coming down in buckets over the Sierra and over the Northern Mountains. That's something that we can certainly do a lot better when it comes to forecasting, and it was a very intriguing phenomena to me.
Yeah, I agree with Tom there. I remember a couple winters ago where if I were to answer that question a couple winters ago, it would have been, when we had a lot of tornadoes. And, there wasn't anything really, like, catching different, like, with like that. We had a lot of cold core storm systems that came from, like, the Gulf of Alaska, and they set up the right situation where we had a lot of little tornadoes. But yeah, like what Tom is saying, that phenomenon, this kind of the shadowing, we call it, it's basically when we have a lot of stronger winds at middle elevations, like a mile or two up in the atmosphere, and it blows over the coastal range, and it causes basically what we call like a downslope type effect, where it ends up shadowing the Central Valley, but it has the opposite effect when the wind goes and blows up the foothills and into the Sierra. So that was a little bit more pronounced, I guess, this year. And I guess maybe that was, if you know, looking back on it, it's probably just because of the jet stream being a little bit stronger with the El Nino and causing that phenomenon. But that, other than that, it wasn't too unnormal of a winter, really.
You're listening to Blue Dot, and we are talking to National Weather Service Sacramento office forecasters Bill Rosch and Tom Dang. Before we look ahead to what may be coming this spring and early summer, how does one become a forecaster for the National Weather Service? Where did you guys get your training, and how did you arrive in Sacramento?
Well, I can take that first, Tom. This is Bill, and I'd love to hear Tom's side of this, too. This is, I think, the really interesting part, at least working for the National Weather Service. We really get people from all over the place. I grew up in North Dakota, and the thing that just interested me were the thunderstorms growing up in North Dakota. That may not be the first thing you think about North Dakota. I think a lot of people think of the winters, and that was really fun, too. But the thunderstorms just really made it so interesting to me. And also, there's a lot of agriculture in North Dakota, and there's a lot of, like, folklore-type things that my parents, their parents taught them, things like, hey, it might rain 30 days after a fog, or you see a certain caterpillar or something like that. So those kind of things interested me. So I actually did kind of, like, little research into it. I would research the folklore-type things. Started when I was, like, in fifth and sixth grade, and just started to do my first kind of research into it. That led to, I guess, you know, to be a meteorologist, you do need to have a lot of science. You need to have a lot of math and physics. I did go to the University of North Dakota, which has a great program over there, and then got my college degree in that. And certainly, you know, the biggest thing is just to have your heart and your desire on meteorology. The mathematics and the physics that you have to go through are pretty rigorous, and I wasn't that good at that, but my love for meteorology was stronger, and I had to work super hard. I had to work really hard to get through those difficult classes, but the community is kind of a tight-knit community, and there's not a lot of meteorology-degreed people out there. You get a camaraderie thing, get going, and it's just a really fun field to be in, but science... sciences are definitely something you need. And then there's a handful of universities all over the place to get your college degree in.
How long have you been working out of the Sacramento office, and what are some of the area's particular challenges? You know, you spoke about every office is difficult. What are some of the challenges for our location, our part of the state?
I got some ideas, Tom. I'll let you start on that one since you're doing more forecasting than me right now anyway.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. This is Tom speaking again. I've actually been here for 7 to 8 years now. I moved here in 2008. For people that were living here in 2008, they may remember in early 2008 there was a really strong windstorm early in January, I believe, and then the major fire outbreak in the summer of 2008. I moved here right after those two major events, so I didn't get to quite experience those. But I've been here for a while now, so I've had plenty of opportunity to experience a lot of what California has to offer. And I would say, and Bill may agree with me with this, but maybe not, you know, one of the biggest challenges is maybe forecasting severe weather, tornadoes and really strong thunderstorms. This is kind of like a hidden secret to the rest of the United States, but the Central Valley is kind of, in a way, kind of a severe thunderstorm hotspot when it comes to the western U.S., and particularly in a location between, like, Redding and down to maybe Chico, Oroville, Marysville. there's just a really hot spot where, you know, tornadoes are kind of prone to form, and if not even tornadoes, then just really strong thunderstorms. They're not easy to forecast for here in California, and we do, you know, we're familiar with their existence. We're getting a whole lot better at it, and computer models have definitely come a long way, even in just my 7 years here. But if there's one big challenge, that would probably be it, forecasting those tornadoes and thunderstorms.
I can attest to what you're talking to, because we had an incredible thunderstorm earlier this year with lots of hail and lightning. And I was in Red Bluff, and the storm was just north of Corning. And it sounded like a war down there.
And I remember seeing like some of the footage from Corning on that event. I remember that event pretty clearly, actually. And I saw that there was, you know, hail that was 4 or 5, 6 inches deep. It was quite incredible what came out of that storm.
You are listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlom, and we are talking to National Weather Service forecasters Bill Rausch and Tom Deng. They join us from the Sacramento office. What's the outlook for this spring? What kinds of things do you generally look for as we head into April and May?
I'll let you take that one, Bill.
Yeah, it's you know, typically I think April 1st is our last snow survey. So really when April and beyond is coming, that's kind of when things are starting to ramp down. Our wedding season is starting to end. But that being said, this is the time of the year if we are going to get tornadoes or strong thunderstorms. This is certainly when the sun angle is high enough where we can heat up a lot. And if we have a cold system that comes down, it creates the proper conditions, we can definitely get thunderstorms. Once, you know, we're getting to the point now, too, where the snowstorms, the storms are pretty warm, so the snow levels are pretty high. And thankfully this year we've had enough moisture, so fire weather issues, which gets to be our big concern going into the summertime, hopefully that will be delayed this year, which hasn't been the case, you know, the last 4 years or so. We just hop into fire weather season so quickly because the grass is brown up, but there's a lot of green grass out there this year. So hopefully maybe this will be a somewhat normal, quote-unquote normal spring, but a typical spring would bring us some, you know, showers and thunderstorms, maybe a couple wind events here and there like we're having right now. But in general, you know, the later the spring is, it's starting to slow down a little bit.
Matt, you do a lot of the weather information for the station here. Is there anything you'd like to ask the forecasters, Bill and Tom?
Well, you know, guys, we see these statistics a lot, you know, 20% chance of showers. And I think to a lot of people listening, maybe listening right now, that just seems sort of it seems whimsical. Maybe you can talk a little bit about those statistics, where those come from.
I would love to talk about that. I'd like Tom to jump in too, if you could. You know what? That's one of the things with the Weather Service, and that's something, a 20% chance of, you know, something. We've been doing that for so long, and I you know, there might be a better way of doing it, but with weather and probabilities, it's like the best way we could think about doing. But I do think in general, speaking in general, people don't understand what we're trying to say, which is a bad thing because people really should understand what we're saying. But there, you know, there's just, because weather is this uncertain thing. All you have to do is look as close as this weather system that affected Northern California this weekend. The storm system was dropping down, coming from the north, and some computer models had it going off into Lake Nevada, and some commute models had it further to the west. So as a meteorologist, and you're trying to communicate that to, say, somebody that has outdoor plans on Thanksgiving Day, you know, my mom would say, hey, you know, I'm going to take the kids out to an Easter egg hunt, and I'm looking at my weather maps, and I see one of my computer models taking a storm system way off to the east where nothing would happen, and one of them is bringing them over the top of us. So, you know, what is the correct way to message that? One of the ways is to put this percentage on it where we can say, well, you know what, the computer that's going to the east, that's the one that's usually better. So I bet it's going to be dry. But if I were to do this scenario 10 times, there might be, you know, there's that slight chance, whatever this slight chance may be, this 20% chance, that's how we can currently communicate it, to say that, well, you know, maybe this thing may go a little bit further west. So it's just one way of kind of communicating that uncertainty. But what I would much rather do is have a conversation like we just did. And I think that's what we're trying to do more and more as a National Weather Service. We're trying to get ourselves out there, add value, talking to people, putting our people in situations where we're right with emergency managers, we're right with people that are making decisions, and we're having those, trying to have those conversations. But of course, we can't be everywhere at once. So one of the ways is to use these percentage type things. Also, we're doing more and more conversational things on social media where we don't have to say a 20% chance. We can say something like, well, right now, our confidence just isn't really high on this happening. Here's what we think might happen, but hey, call tomorrow, check back in tomorrow. We might know more, we might more information. I don't know if that helps at all, but...
Well, it lifts the veil a little bit, I think. You know, I think it's good to hear that from actual humans who are trying to predict these things.
Yeah. That's one thing, too. You know, we're just like your neighbors. We're normal people. And generally speaking, we're just very passionate about the weather, and we're really trying our best. And in general, too, meteorologists, we don't like to be wrong. So we hate it when we say something is going to happen and it doesn't. We feel terrible. We go home and we feel bad. So, you know, as far as, you know, weathermen in general, weather people, we're real people just like everybody else. And when we get something wrong, we feel terrible. But we try our best to get it right.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schloem, and we have been talking to Bill Rosch and Tom Dang, National Weather Service forecasters from the Sacramento office. And we're about out of time, guys, but I would like to ask you really quick, what do you most enjoy about your work?
One misconception, well, it's somewhat true, but it is a joke that, you know, kind of runs out there, is that, you know, weather forecasters are the one profession where you can get your job wrong and still get paid for it. In a way, it's true, but it's not really telling the full story. We as meteorologists are basically, we're doing what is basically, it was impossible a generation ago. I mean, just weather forecasts, they didn't exist, you know, 50 years ago. So what we're doing now is pretty incredible when you consider that backdrop. So when you consider that, I mean, when we nail a forecast, especially these, you know, really high impact events, say a tornado, a severe thunderstorm, or really big flood events, you know, getting the forecast is really nice. But then hearing that, you know, people actually took actions, you know, they drove a different way to get into work, they stayed at home because if it was a really big wind event, that sort of thing. Getting that sort of feedback from our users that they took direct actions because of our forecasts, that means a lot to me.
Yeah, that's well said, Tom.
Bill and Tom, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bill Rosch and Tom Dang, National Weather Service forecasters from the Sacramento office. You're listening to Blue Dot. When we come back, we'll be talking to Channel 7R meteorologist Rob Elvington on the differences between forecasting for television audiences versus the National Weather Service. You're listening to Blue Dot, and we are talking to Rob Elvington, forecaster for KRCR Channel 7 in Reading. And Rob, I'd like to know, we've been talking to forecasters from the National Weather Service in Sacramento. As a television forecaster, what role does the NWS play in your work?
I would say the biggest role that the National Weather Service plays in my role is I kind of spread or communicate some of the watches, warnings, or advisories, so some of the bigger threats that they issue. A lot of people may not know that whenever there's a severe thunderstorm warning or a frost advisory, that's not coming from me. That's coming from the Weather Service. So one of my big jobs is to relay those watches, warnings, and advisories to get those out, you know, give the specifics when they go into effect or expire. So I would say that's probably one of the biggest things that I need to do when I'm working together with the Weather Service.
Now, how is preparing a forecast for television, how is that different from what they do?
Now, they do a lot of stuff other than just, you know, your lows and your highs. They do a lot of river forecasting, even marine forecasting along the coast, whereas with me, you know, I'm more prepared or worried about what the high and the low is and, you know, chances for rain. So I say that's where we differ a lot. There's a lot of stuff that they do that you know, may not concern the general public. A lot of their forecasting is for other agencies preparing for, you know, different types of impacts the weather might occur. So they do a lot of kind of niche forecasting that doesn't involve, like, the general public.
How long have you been forecasting in our area now?
Just past 5 years. So, yeah, 5 years in with the North State.
What are some of the peculiarities of forecasting in this part of the state that you've learned over the years?
With this part of the state, it's, you know, it's definitely you're having the big impacts or of the changes in the elevation. So you're getting a lot of what we call orographics. So you have a lot of mountain to foothill to valley terrain effects. We get a valley wind that develops. You get drainage winds. So you've got these winds that either get blow up the valley or blow down the valley. We have a lot of low-level jets that set up, especially on the western and the northern side of the valley. When those winds actually come down the mountains, they compress and warm up. That's because they're going from a lower pressure to a higher pressure, so it's a compression wind. So that actually brings a little bit of warmer air, but it also dries out the air. So that's kind of a concern when we head into the spring and summer months. You get that dry wind coming down the mountains, which really helps to lower the humidity values, which increases fire danger.
We had a pretty wet El Nino winter. Give us your assessment on the weather we've had during the period of, like, December to March.
You know, with, you know, all El Ninos, not every single El Nino is similar. What's amazing about this El Nino, it was one of the strongest on record, just going by plain temperature anomalies in the equatorial Pacific. It peaked just over 3 degrees Celsius above the long-term average right in the main El Nino region. But what I've noticed with this El Nino is that the warmest anomalies and the most lift in the atmosphere in the equatorial Pacific was closer to the dateline, so 180 degrees west in the equatorial Pacific, and that was a little bit further west than the 1997-1998 El Nino. So that had impacts on the jet stream a little bit further west. So what we saw was the strong jet lifted a little bit further north as it got closer to the west coast because of that, the impacts further west out in the Pacific. And that's likely why we saw less impact in Southern California and more of an impact in Northern California. So, you know, Southern California is still wondering where their rain is, whereas we had a pretty good winter. You know, it wasn't as impressive as the 82-83 El Nino or the 97-98 El Nino, but we did pretty well. And, of course, we still have April and, what, half of May to go, looking pretty dry through the next 7 to 10 days, but still, you know, about 6 weeks to go in the water year.
And it seems like it was a fairly cold winter in terms of we were able to maintain a good snowpack.
I wouldn't call it a cold winter, but the storms that we got were cold enough to do pretty well with the snowpack. We actually finished about 3 degrees Fahrenheit above average for most of the region, so it was above average warmth. But a lot of our storms, and especially the ones in December into early January, they were cold, so we had cold storms at the right time. You got that base snowpack, and then when we started to see warmer storm systems in February, we already had that snowpack base in place. I think that helped out a little bit because the snow levels did run a little bit higher than that very wet, March or earlier this month, but we had just enough snowpack to do pretty well. And because we're actually starting to fall below average as we head into the very important April 1st snowpack, right now, as of today, we're at about 86% of average.
Looking ahead, what are some of the particular things you'll be looking at as we go into spring and leading into early summer?
I guess the big thing is watching where we're heading with the current El Nino. So it is starting to weaken rapidly. Right now, we're at 1.5 degrees Celsius above the long-term average in the main El Nino region. So we're still way into El Nino, but it is weakening very quickly. And a lot of forecasts and a lot of the climate models suggest that we're going to go neutral, which means not El Nino or La Nina, likely in the next 6 to 7 weeks. And we could very well be heading into a La Nina by the mid to late summer months. And that will have a big impact as we head into the fall and the winter of next year. And if we do head into a La Nina a little bit faster than that, that actually can have impacts on our summer. We can actually have cooler summers if we get into that La Nina, let's say by the early summer months. But it definitely depends on how fast we transition to that.
It's amazing how much the ocean so far away affects our weather locally.
Yeah, the tropics, especially the Pacific, have a huge role in pretty much the global climate. You have all the solar insulation coming into the tropics of the Pacific, and that heats up the Pacific, and you get all this release of energy into the atmosphere, and that plays a huge role in the jet stream. So, and it's not just El Nino and La Nina, it's also what we call the MJO, and that is a kind of a mini El Nino. It's a wave that goes around the globe along the equator, and that has a big impact on the jet stream. So it's all about the tropics when you're looking at seasonal forecasts.
Well, Rob, it's great talking to you as always, and keep an eye on the weather for us.
Will do. Should be interesting heading out of this big El Nino.
Yes, it will be. We'll have to, and I'm sure you will keep us apprised. Rob Elvington, thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me on.
That's Rob Elvington, forecaster for KRCR Channel 7 in Reading. Well, Matt, that was really interesting to hear about the weather, and I hope you listening out there enjoyed getting a little more information about what it's like to be a forecaster for the National Weather Service.
Absolutely. These guys, I think people who hear about the weather, and you out there in your car right now listening to weather reports, it kind of just seems like numbers, probabilities, these clouds are going to do this, this wind's going to do that. But it's really just people who have a scientific background who are making formulations and trying to predict pretty chaotic stuff. And it's kind of amazing that they can predict it with the accuracy that they do.
And it really, you know, if you look at the short-term forecasts, you know, 1, 2, 3 days out, they really are very accurate. You know, they use the word accuracy and precision in our interview, and those have very specific meanings that in everyday usage we interchange. But accuracy means how close are you to the true target? So if I'm talking about an accurate forecast, if I say that it's going to be raining 1 inch and it rains, you know, 0.99 inches, that's accurate. Precision means how can you reproduce those forecasts? So if over the course of a month, you know, 90% of your forecasts were accurate, that's high precision. It's the reproducibility.
And we'd like to thank our meteorologists for their high level of precision.
They're very precise and very accurate, and they are, you know, really neat people. It was really interesting to talk to them, and we're going to have them on again. You've been listening to Blue Dot, a production of North State Public Radio. Follow us at NSPR News or me at Dave Shlom, and I'm reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.